Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming out in the rain here to Sister Resistors. Just want to remind you that all of the authors are going to have books available for purchase and signing right after we're done here, so you are welcome to go and join them outside. I'm Sarah Redker. I'm the events manager at Porter Square Books in Cambridge, where we are the delightful happy new proprietors of a romance section. So I am delighted to share some romance authors with you. We have Isabel Cooper, who is a publishing project manager by day and has a secret identity as a paranormal romance author, including the Dawn of the Highland Dragon series. Caroline Linden has a math degree from Harvard and wrote computer code until she discovered it was much more fun to write romance. She's been translated into 17 languages and has won a number of awards, including the Rita. Sarah McLean is a New York Times and USA Today best-selling author and also writes a monthly Washington Post column featuring the best of romance. Falguni Kothari is the author of Unconventional Love Stories and Kick-Ass Fantasies. She's written four novels that are shaped by her South Asian heritage and her expat experience, and her latest novel was reviewed in the Times. And Grace Burroughs is a New York Times and USA Today best-selling author of Georgian, Regency, Scottish, Victorian, and contemporary romance. So she covers the spectrum. So we are delighted to have you all here today, and I want to start by asking you what makes romance a particularly feminist genre, or what doesn't?
And the crowd went wild.
You had good thoughts on this, Grace. Do you want to start?
I get to start. First of all, thank you all so much for coming out on a dreary day when it's raining, and it's just so lovely of you to be here. I have something of a bad fairy perspective on this question of feminism and romance, because I don't think romance is particularly feminist. There are many good romances that don't have a female protagonist. There are good romances that don't have a male protagonist. I think our message is larger than gender. In that, in a well-written romance novel, both or all three or all six protagonists must grow and change. They must, love must give them the courage to deal with unresolved trauma, so that by the end of the book, they have their priorities on right, their life is driven by love rather than fear, and a happily ever after is something they have earned and know how to guard. However, the context in which we write romance has become, I think we have graduated from toxic patriarchy to cannibalistic patriarchy. And in that context, there's very little literature of happiness. If you think about Jack Reacher, he's not a happy guy. There's very little literature of transformation. Romance, though, is literature of transformation and ultimately of joy and love. And given the context we're in, women are especially deprived of that message. So I think it may have a feminist impact. I hope it also has a humanist impact. That's my perspective.
I'll go, because I have the other side of that coin. While absolutely there are fabulous romances without female protagonists or male protagonists, I think the genre as a whole has always stood alongside feminism as the only genre that honors the female gaze as a matter of course, as the only genre that, as a genre that is largely written, and many of you have heard this before, by, for, and about women. The first book in the genre was that we sort of point to as the birth of the modern romance novel was written in 1972 alongside the women's movement. It was an adventure novel with a woman at the center of it, which had never existed. It was an adventure novel that put women on the page having sex and having an orgasm and having pleasure in a way that we'd never seen sex on the page ever before. And I think those kind of things, sexual agency, sexual power, parity, equality, and a sense of ultimately coming to a place where the heroine and the hero stand together and face the world as equal partners is ultimately a metaphor and a reflection of the feminist movement, right? Like women in society. And that's why I think we need romance now more than ever to continue to have this conversation about how women and patriarchy exist in the world and how women can change the world to become equal to stand as equal partners with men.
Y'all want to clap? Yeah.
So I was never going to be a writer. I was a serious nerd in high school, but I always did like to read. And just the women that you read in classical literature, like Madame Bovary and the woman in The Awakening and, you know, Anna Karenina, those women are just so incredibly ground down by the society that says, you know, you're not allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do that, you're not worthy, you're not, you know, this is indecent for you. Like, the ending of The Awakening just broke my heart entirely and completely. And so I think romance is a wonderful reaction to that. I think it's not an accident that it's mostly written by women saying, you know what, the world is not going to grind me down. The world is not going to make me throw myself on the train tracks or walk off into the ocean because I just can't bear the garbage of the men around me anymore. I'm going to find a decent man who respects me, who understands that my wishes and my desires are as important as his, that I'm an equal partner, and that we're both better together that way. So that's my non-literature major take on it.
I really don't have anything to say. I think these three said it beautifully. I read a lot of romance before I started writing romance. I grew up in India. I grew up in the midst of Bollywood movies and a lot, stacks and stacks of Harlequin category romances, Milton Boons. It's not a thing here, but it was huge in India. And what I loved about it was they showed women in every single aspect of life, mm-hmm. from being housewives, from being, you know, scientists, to cowgirls, or, it, you know, helping their, whatever, cowboy boyfriends do something. And for me, it was, as Sarah said, about equality. She had as much stage presence as the guy did, and I love that. And I think for me, romance stands for that. It's both of them together, it's the relationship together, it's the commitment that both of them have equally, and because of that, because of each other, they change in beautiful and positive ways.
I mean, everybody else, absolutely, I agree with the... And this is the problem with going last. I would also like to say on a more both physical but also emotional level, what I like about romance from a feminist perspective is it encourages women not to settle, not to be picky, mm-hmm. or to be picky, rather. I grew up where the expectation for men that you'd end up with was Homer Simpson or Raymond or, you know, whatever the schlubby guy that the really hot lawyer on Sex and the City ends up with, that kind of thing. It's like, oh, but you have to end up with him because he's such a nice guy, even if he has no other qualities. And one of the things I love about romance, and unabashedly so, and will defend, is saying, no, I want, you know, and it's fine to want, a hero who looks good, who attracts you on a physical level, who has his own agency and his own life, and who brings more to the table than thinking you're pretty and, you know, whatever, being around kind of thing. That women, in addition to, say, I'm going to go out and do things, are saying, it is better to do these things on my own or with my friends than to settle for the first guy who makes me feel like he's been vaguely helpful.
I love that. Thank you. All right. Could each of you talk about one of the first female characters from literature or pop culture who inspired you and shaped the characters that you write?
I'll go first. I don't know how many of you know about the Indian epics called the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. So in the Mahabharata, we have Draupadi, who is a ball buster. And we're talking about these epics that were written, or at least in the oral tradition, were thought of 3,000 years ago. She had 5 husbands, which I thought was cool, how she was handling that whole situation. I mean, I can't handle one. And she pretty much, like Helen of Troy, decided the fate of all of them. Like, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to her children? Who's going to get which kingdom? And funny story, when I was growing up, my grandmother lived with us, and every morning she'd wake me up to stories about Draupadi and the female, the female leads or the female characters of the Mahabharata. And I didn't realize until much, much later that wasn't a thing that was done, because most of these epics are told through a male point of view. Mm-hmm. And she was giving me the female perspectives, and that was just, I don't know, amazing. So that was one of the characters that I base my stories out of. Strong, ball-busting women, little prickly, will make 1,000 mistakes, but it's a learning experience. And the second one was, I think, Elizabeth Bennet. I simply adore her. I would kill her, though, because I want Darcy. But, yeah, we all know her and love her.
I was always a fan of Eleanor of Aquitaine, who was one of the richest heiresses in the world at the age of 15. She got married to the Crown Prince of France, became the Queen of France, had some kids with him, divorced him, married an up-and-coming Englishman who became Henry II, had a whole bunch more kids with him. She instituted the courtly love phenomenon at her courts. She was a power player her entire life in the politics of the society that she moved in, until her husband finally shut her up by locking her in a castle for the last few years. Like, that's what it took to put that woman down. But she was definitely undaunted and strong and was not going to settle.
I'm sitting over here with a blank slate. I'm thinking Hildegard von Bingen. Well, that's really reaching. It was probably the absence of inspiring female protagonists that drove me to write the way I do. I think about Jane Austen, who essentially had to choose whether to be married or write. That's a hideous choice, and I'm glad she chose door number two. So I think I wrote from a place of, there's nobody out there like me. Mm-hmm. This is especially true in children's literature. Yeah. So that would be my answer, that I wrote the characters I wanted to see. And the older I get, the more I am inspired by my mother and grandmother, who were handed such... Walter Scott has a really cool term. He refers to oaths too foul to be rendered on the page. And that's how I feel about the deal my mother, who had 7 kids, and my grandmother, who had 5 kids, got. I don't want their stories to be where it ends. I want a happily ever after for everybody. Everybody in this room, everybody on this panel. So that's the place I write from.
You go. I am a little more pop culture, I think. The first one I remember really idolizing is Meriwether in the Sleeping Beauty Disney movie, who not only are the fairies really the protagonists, but Meriwether of all of the fairies is just the most taking exactly no crap. Like, no, I still remember the, oh, we can only do things to, right, exactly, or we can't turn her into a toad, we can only do things to make people happy. Well, that would make me happy, which I loved. And then when I grew older, Robin McKinley's Aaron in The Hero and the Crown, who is this, in the 21st century, looking back, it's like, oh, there's a lot of rebellious princesses. But she was the first one I encountered, and she's the king's daughter by his sort of questionable second wife, who everybody thought was a witch, and she is not pretty by her people's standards, and she grows up and decides that, screw it, I'm going to go slay dragons because I know how to do this and nobody else has figured out the alchemy. It's not an inborn thing. She spends a lot of time experimenting with weird herbs and creates a fireproofing thing and goes off and saves the world and ends up having a happily sort of ever after with 2 different guys sort of successively, which I also liked. So,
My favorite children's book, without question, was Madeline.
Yes.
And if you had asked me 3 years ago, you know, why, I would not have been able to tell you why, except she had appendicitis, and for some reason I wanted to have it too. But now I have a five-year-old daughter, and we read Madeline a lot because Madeline is fearless and kind of reckless, but very fearless. Like, she's not afraid of mice or tigers, or and she's constantly sort of one footing it on the bridge at the Pont Neuf, like making her governess terrified. And I feel like that fearlessness is something that has always attracted me to heroines in literature, and to it's always been a piece of my own heroines to a certain extent. Even the Wallflowers like end up having to realize that risk is essential in life, and fearlessness is essential in life in every day. And also as a writer, I don't know if process is coming, but I don't actually outline. I have no idea what is coming next on the page, and that fearlessness, like I have to believe in fearlessness in order to get words on the page. And maybe Madeline is that, maybe it's all because of Madeline.
All right, well, a sort of process question. What does it take, especially if you're writing a historical, to create a protagonist who's totally believable in the world that you've created, but also appeals to your 21st century readers who are mostly female and want to see empowered women?
I don't think there's any disconnect in my mind between writing historical fiction or romances set in the 18, right now I'm writing in the 1830s, and writing a heroine who appeals and is recognizable to a modern reader. Lizzie Bennet came up, and you know, Lizzie Bennet was pretty modern on a number of levels. Austen was modern on a number of levels. So I don't think it's that's hard to assume that there were feminist, strong, risk-taking, fearless women in the world. We know that they existed because we've read about Eleanor of Aquitaine, or we've read the myths of many different cultures. So I never think about it. I write the character, and I assume that because I'm my age in my time, you know, readers will she'll appeal to them, but she's also historically accurate.
I think there have always been strong women who broke the mold and said, you know what, these rules of society are not working for me. And because otherwise, you know, why would things change? It was women who went out and said, we deserve the vote. It was women who went out and said, you know what, if my husband is a jerk, I deserve the right to divorce him. I do not belong to him. I am not property. It was women who protested and enforced those changes. Men just didn't decide, oh, you know what, we just ought to give it to them. So there have all along been women who, you know, who weren't born to lives of pampered splendor where everything was easy, and so why would they rebel against it? There have always been women saying, you know, I deserve more, whether it was Madame de Stael, I don't know, I speak French, I can't pronounce her name. But she was, you know, there were Ada Lovelace, you know, talked about things as well, and there just always, I think, have been women saying, you know, we deserve more, we deserve to be equal. If a man can do it, why can't I? So I don't really view writing historical characters as having to write sheltered and restrained and dignified and very, you know, kind of timid misses, because there are still today people who are conservative and don't want to break out of their box, and that's fine, frankly, I think, is, you know, as a woman, you have the right to choose how you want to live your life. But there have always been women who push the boundaries. So I don't think there's any real problem with making one of them historical.
I love writing in the Regency period, because the more you study it, the more you realize it very closely parallels the current situation, in that the Napoleonic Wars raged for years, millions of men dead, leaving a big power vacuum. And the ladies back home were managing the shops, they were raising the kids, they were tending to the books. You know, in France, the situation was even worse. The women were running the whole country. They were the only ones left, because all the men had been slaughtered. And then the men return home from war, bringing with them virulent syphilis. And
it's not wrong.
It's a thing.
Yeah.
And because the strain of syphilis that Napoleon's army sort of spread all over Europe was much worse than what had been gone before. And these guys want their power back. And you see women's dress become more and more restrictive. You see this sort of hyper-Victorian erasing of all of the fun and adventurous legacy that Regency women left. You see men pushing women out of the birthing room and bringing with them, diseases, because they were physicians who dealt with sick people, as opposed to the midwives who were birth specialists. Birth became more expensive, women died, children died, but men were in charge. And no one could stop this. So it feels to me like the parallels with the modern situation where for-profit healthcare and, you know, Texas having the worst maternal death statistics in the developed world. And I can't write about that in the present day without clearly getting on my advocacy soapbox, but I can wrap a duke around it. And then I get to not only entertain people and get paid for it, but also, I hope, make people think a little bit, even if it's just between one page and the next, about what has changed, what needs to change, how are our daughters going to manage this. So I think the sort of historical layer gives you another little a free pass into suspension of disbelief that you can really use effectively.
And not one of your dudes has syphilis.
So far.
The next 10 are going to. So I don't write historical. My fantasy is based in on the epic, the Mahabharata. And I already said that I chose one of the main heroines is Draupadi with her five husbands, and then she has an extra lover thrown in. The thing is, as Grace said, that the whole epic, the way it's written in India or the way it's told in India, it's about the male perspective, and the only thing the men seemed to want to do was conquer and pillage and, you know, go to war. So there wasn't really any story to tell but through the women, because they were the ones who were actually doing what needed to be done on a day-to-day level. And I think that's kind of what I've put into my fantasy, except for there's also magic and demons and gods and all of that, which makes it interesting.
I also have a lot of magic, demons, etc. In mind, which when I'm writing Victorian and medieval makes it a little easier because, you know, if my heroine is a dragon, then it's very difficult for men to tell her exactly what to do, and, you know, the birth control issue can be solved because magic. That said, I spent a lot of time, mostly at work, since I don't have that job anymore, I will say, researching things like attitudes towards female sexuality in the 1300s or whatever. And I realized that, as people said, there are a lot of things and a lot of attitudes that weren't always universal. There are always pockets of resistance. There are always pockets of forward thinking. And it's not a straight progression. You had, in the earlier Middle Ages, a lot more female agency, women being blacksmiths, women being warriors, frankly, a lot more sex, and a lot more acceptance of homosexuality. And then a number of things happened, and men, in particularly straight white guys, started taking over and really enforcing much stricter standards. And it really goes back and forth. As Grace said, the women running things, and then women, and then men coming back and wanting power. You see that within my mother's and grandmother's memory in the 40s and then the 50s. And it's always, there are always these periods of If I am to cast the patriarchy as Sauron, the shadow takes another shape and grows again. But there are always also periods of resistance and periods when it gets better.
Well, it's a very interesting point that men who, you know, generally are the ones going off to fight the wars, and they go off and they kill each other, and that really does open up a lot of things where women have to step in. You know, everybody knows in World War II it was the women who went to the factories, and I just started reading a book about women being recruited to crack codes for the Army and the Navy, and one of the companies recruiting told the recruiters to pick especially attractive women for their code-breaking team because they didn't want to be saddled with them after the war. They wanted women who were definitely going to get married and not stick around and be like, yeah, we want to keep our jobs. So, yeah.
All right.
It's real, you guys.
Yeah.
Patriarchy.
Well, but the men are being killed. Well, it isn't any great deal for them either.
True.
No.
That is true. And setting the men aside a little bit, you know, aside from the crucial romance, female friendships are also really important to the protagonists of all of your novels. Can you talk a little bit about what role that plays for you?
I am one of seven kids. So my first friends were my siblings, and they remain some of my dearest, dearest friends. And I think often the role of the sort of the secondary characters is before you have the courage to put it all on the table in an intimate relationship, you tidy up the relationships around you. You may be a little braver with the mom you've never gotten along with. You may apologize to your friend for stealing her boyfriend in high school. You sort of try on your courage and put on your superhero clothes in the bedroom when there aren't any superheroes there. So I think those the friendships are they're so gratifying to us as readers because we don't just want to ride into the sunset with somebody else. We want a whole community that's founded on healthy and caring principles. So I think the friendships bring that depth to the books. And that's a problem with a solitary hero or heroine. This is why I have my characters end up talking to their horses, having dialogues with gravestones or portraits, because they don't even have the capability to sustain a friendship. Yeah. That's pretty sad.
So all of my books have Indian protagonists, and they're based, they may not be based in India, but even if the setting is wherever it is in the world or in the universe, family plays a huge, huge, huge role because family plays a huge role in India. Like, I grew up with dozens of cousins, and, you know, we grew up in a building structure where you just go down and you play with hundreds of kids, you know? So that's like, and there's no sense of space there. Like, people will come and stand right in front of you and say, like, what are you doing today? But I don't want to talk to you. No, but you have to talk to me. So all of my books are like that. The family plays a huge role. Nobody is alone. Even if they want to be, even when they want to shut the room and just be by themselves and think about their, you know, whatever's going on in their lives, nobody will leave them alone. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, informs also when you're reading about a whole family or you're reading about, you know, who is standing either behind your hero or your heroine, it informs you of that person. Like, look, she had these many friends, or, you know, she has one friend or 20 friends, or, you know, she's so close to her mother, she's not close. So those relationships also inform of character. So they are important, and I love writing about them, and it adds so much masala to everything. As met Sarah's sister yesterday, and the two of them are absolutely adorable together. So I'm an only child. I am so jealous of that. I'm trying to get them to adopt me.
One sister is too many.
No. You know, just that scene, to put that into a book, it would be amazing. And then you want to read about that. You constantly don't want to read about, well, my heart is breaking, or this is happening, or that is happening. You want the whole picture, because we all lead lives that are not just romantic or that are not just work-based. We have a whole life, and, you know, you show that in the book.
I write communities in all of my series. I've written brotherhoods of men. I've written five sisters. I'm right now writing brothers again, and a blended family of people who are both blood related and not. And I think family and friendship. I'm really fascinated. I'm fascinated by male friendship. I'm not male, and so I'm not a man, and so I don't know what it's like. But I have like a fantasy of like what it could be like if decent men were friends with each other. Right? And that's not to say I'm sure every man in this room is a decent man and has decent friends. But I think there's this. I think the one thing that we get to do in stories that end in happiness is write really wonderful, noble characters who are sometimes terrible at the start and then find their nobility over the course of a story. And it's not enough for love. Love is not enough to do that. You have to have there's a great big world around you, and terrible people alone, one person is not going to change them. We know that from our own lives. So I think it's impossible. I mean, it's not impossible. Nothing is impossible. But I think it's difficult to tell a story of the evolution of a character from, say, scoundrel to, you know, noble hero without a world of people around him to, you know, be water on stone. And I love a scoundrel.
It's true.
Okay. You said one sister is too many. You don't have many brothers, though, do you?
I do have a brother.
Do you?
Yeah. I do.
Oh, you just never talk about
him. He's fine.
Well, you're lucky then. He's four brothers, and they're not all fine.
Seems like too many brothers.
There's way too many brothers. And they're all younger. They were on the super annoying, you know, degrees of younger. And one of them is, like, a lot younger than I am. And so once the two of the brothers, who were only a little bit younger than I, taught this baby brother, who is 16 years younger than I am, they taught him to call me mommy.
Oh.
Ooh.
Yeah. So they suck. They're dead to me. But so I'm also one of seven, and it was very interesting that you said your siblings are your closest friends, because I hardly talk to any of mine. So in my books, it's really more the family that you make, and all of my heroes and heroines have a best friend. They have their BFF, somebody that they can talk to, because that is an important part of life, having somebody where you can honestly say, you know, I think I like this person, but I'm not so sure about this and that and the other, and, you know, I have these issues, and, you know, somebody who just gets you, who is not a romantic relationship. And I think that's a really important thing to have in your life, at least that one person. Some of my characters have lots of friends, and some of them are, you know, definitely more on the, you know, there is only one true friend. But yeah, it is an important part. I don't rely on family that much.
For me, it's very much, and I have one sister. We get along well now. There were some times up until there was a point where we were both home on Christmas in our 20s, and I told my parents that if Emmy didn't stop saying that I was what was wrong with America for taking the last cinnamon roll, one of us was going to the hospital. It was a lot of scotch that Christmas. For me, it's very much, I always try to think when I'm doing creating my heroes or my heroines, what would they be doing if they hadn't met this person? Because I totally agree. Love is not enough. You have to have a life outside your romantic partner. And you have to have a life going on, I think, before you're in a good place to meet and be a functional adult in a romantic relationship, which is ideally what everybody's going for. And I think part of that is having friends. And part of that is, you know, yes, there are circumstances where it's like, all right, I just came from 200 years ago and I don't know anybody here. Asking for a friend. But in general, I always try to think, what would my character be doing otherwise if this other person wasn't around? And for a lot of that, I draw on my own experience, which is, all right, I do these things, but mostly I hang out with my friends and watch trashy movies and drink strange purple alcohol. That does not always make it into the books. But,
yeah. All right, and continuing with the idea of community, romance is a very connected community. How has that shaped you as a writer and as a reader?
You mean the community of readers? And
or of other romance writers.
Oh, okay.
I can toss this out there. I have been a single mom for the duration. I have 4 academic degrees. I am the expert in my jurisdiction on child welfare law to the point that the judges ask me what to do. Mm-hmm. And I came to romance late, after beloved offspring had left home. And there was peace and quiet and privacy. But I'd gone to 3 or 4 romance writers' national conferences before I saw a fella with a program in his hands sort of looking around for where's the bathroom, because these conferences are inundated by women. It's 2,000-3,000 women. So the hotels have to convert some of the men's rooms into women's rooms, which involves ferns and tablecloths and a lot of hilarity. And this guy was stumbling around with his program, look, you know, where am I? And that one's already been co-opted, and that one's been co-opted. And I realized for the first time in my life, in my mid-50s, I was in a place where I was not other. I wasn't the wrong gender. I wasn't too intelligent. I wasn't funny looking. I wasn't dressing the wrong way. I wasn't too articulate. I wasn't having to stumble around hoping there was a bathroom that I could use. And I saw this guy and I almost wanted to run up to him and hug him because he was a metaphor for how I think a lot of women of my cohort have had to go through life. There aren't enough bathrooms. You're the wrong gender. You look funny. Everybody here seems to know what they're doing and nobody is making it easier for you. So that was, my next reaction was to sit down and cry. Because to be 55 years old before you don't feel like an other is a crime of intergalactic proportions. And I hope I'm the only person to suffer it, but I don't think I am. Next.
I don't know how I can follow that story. I got into writing accidentally. I hated writing as a child. I hated it.
Me too.
Because in India, the language or English, like I went to an English medium school, it's called there. But although my teachers were fabulous, it's very dry. You don't get to write creatively there. It's very structured. Like, this is how you have to do it. And I just didn't like it. So I never thought I'd be a writer. Now, about 9 or 10 years ago, my children were in middle school, and I was basically doing nothing. I'm a homemaker. I've never worked in my life. And I think I was going around just going slowly insane. I was reading a lot. I was just grumpy all the time. And my mother sat me down, and she's like, listen, you need to do something. You cannot do this for the rest of your life. Your children are gone. I mean, most of, you know, they'll eventually go away. You need to do something with your life. I was like, okay, what should I do? So I decided I'd take some online courses, and I stumbled across this course called Romance Writing Secrets. And oh my God, I felt like Alice, who had just gone into that mad world and just found, you know, I don't know what I'd found. Anyway, so I took that course. It was very short. Somehow, because I read a lot, like I read, I think, probably a couple of books a week, most of them are romance. And I finished writing my story very quickly because all of these ideas, I guess, were just waiting to burst out of me. And without thought, without thinking, without understanding the industry, without understanding what it means to be published or to be published in the US versus to be published in India, because India also has a huge publishing industry, I got a few rejections over here from agents and publishers because my books were too Indian. So I decided to get published in India, which is an easier process because at that point you didn't have to go through an agent to even approach the big. You know, at that point there were 6 publishers and you didn't need an agent to do that. And I think within 6 months I sold my manuscript. Mm-hmm. However, I had no community at that time. This was just, you know, random bumbling about and, you know, just euphoria that, oh my God, I wrote a book. Oh my God, somebody picked it up. So I signed, you know, away. I think I signed my children away to them. And yeah.
I did that too.
And that's when I started looking into publishing in the US or how it's meant to be done or supposed to be done. And that is how I found the Romance Writers of America. And I think that was my first year in 2011 that I went for their first national conference. It was in New York City. And I felt, I was like, I am so stupid. I should have come here first. I made all of these mistakes. But that community, they teach you everything you need to know. They're there for you whenever you need them. They have the information, they have the structure to make you the best writer you can be. And I love that. I love that community.
And they generally have it for free if there are any writers lurking in the room.
There must be a local chapter, right?
There is a local chapter. Yeah, see me afterwards if you want to know about them. The romance community is incredibly supportive, and I came from STEM fields. In high school, I wanted to be an astronaut, and I loved physics, and I'll never forget, there was this big test. It was like one of the state colleges ran this academic tournament, basically, and you went and you took a test, and you had like, took one, and then they gave a medal, and you were like the best in the state, and that year, my junior year, I won the physics medal. Which meant I beat all the boys in my class as well, in my AP physics class, right? And so I was the only girl in the class, and I had taken a lot of crap over the year from these guys. And so I remember walking in on Monday morning with my medal in my bag, just waiting. I was waiting for the humble pie from my very sexist teacher, who was this round little man with a head like an egg. And he comes in, and he says, well, I guess you're the best in the state. And I'm just sitting there going, suck it, you guys. And some guy next to me goes, still a girl, though. And the teacher goes, oh, yeah, that's right. And he went on with the class. So the world I come from was not super supportive. Computer science and math majors are not all that social. I mean, you do problem sets together, but then you're like, that's done. We can leave. So when I wrote my first romance, it was like totally undercover. I told no one I was doing it. I finally admitted to my husband because he was like, what are you typing all night long? Who are you emailing? I'm like, finally, well, it's not really an email. So finding the romance community was like the story of the ugly duckling for me. You know, I was wrong. I never did anything right. I was always on my own. And then I walked into the local chapter and people were like, what do you write? You know, tell me all about it. And I was like, really? You're actually interested? And they were like, yes, tell us about it. And then we'll tell you all this other information that will help you out. So it is the most incredibly supportive community. I think even among writers, I know people who write in other genres who say they joined RWA when they were new just because RWA has so many, that's Romance Writers of America, has so many resources for beginning writers just about craft and about the business of publishing that, you know, is kind of universal, not just particular to romance. So,
yeah. And if you join it and listen, you don't have to give away your children.
Yes, yes. They will tell you what not to do.
Unless you want to, yes.
Did you go?
I'm fine.
I agree. I'm one of those dreadfully introverted young people you hear about. And oftentimes, if if it means putting on pants, I don't leave the house. But I have been really lucky on Twitter and on the blogs online to be in a really great community with my fellow writers, with romance enthusiasts, with people who will just get snarky about snotty New Yorker articles in hilarious and meme-filled ways. And whenever it's gross and rainy outside, I will always check the romance blogs and the feeds and so forth, because they always cheer me up.
All right, and now we'd like to open it up to some questions from the audience.
You. Yep. So you talked a little about female friendships, but sort of the other side of that, one of the debates I have with my friends is whether it's more feminist to sort of not really have the female rivalries that you see pushed on us everywhere else, or is it sort of denying the complexity of female relationships to have all your women be friends? Because I feel like it's kind of tiresome to have the slut shaming or the itchy female rival, but is it fair to ask your female hero or heroines to be friends with all the other females that she meets?
Mine are not all friends.
Yeah. No, it's too complicated. It's complex, right? I mean, the world is complex. Women are complex. Characters should be complex in great books. And so I think the challenge with when we talk about that, the female rival, is that for many, many years, especially in romance, the female rival / villain was a easy kind of trope that writers could fall back on. But the world is changing, and we're able to talk about slut shaming as a real thing now, and we're able to see that women who are strong-willed or have strong personalities or have strong opinions are not all terrible people. And so I say put the strident, strong women in your book and let them butt heads with each other, but be careful about the trope of evil other woman, because she's got to be a heroine of her own story, right? In her own identity.
Yeah. Anybody else want to weigh in? Okay. Back there.
So definitely the non-male-female romances are, I think, a pretty rapidly growing market. They've always been there, but they kind of, I don't know exactly how to describe it. The lesbian market, the menage market, male-male, I think that's been there. It's just been almost, I don't want to say underground, but it definitely wasn't advertising itself to the world in general for the most part. They were looking for their particular audience. And it's definitely spreading to the world at large now, and people are realizing, oh my gosh, there are great gay love stories out there too. And people love them, which is wonderful. I think there's a greater acknowledgement among the publishers that there's a much broader range of stories and voices that could be told that can be successful. But it's so hard to get any book published these days. It just, I don't work at a publisher, and I never have, but the odds are, they're stiff for any book.
Well, and it's also such a chain too, right?
It's the
agents and the editors and the publishers and the distributors and the stores and the customers, and we all need to we all need to start talking about how we can elevate voices that have routinely not been elevated. And the reviewers, I review for the Washington Post, and it takes, you know, somebody recently did an overview of all of the reviews, the major romance reviews, and how we're not doing well enough. We need to do better, all of us. And so, I don't know what you do, but if you seem to be a reader, like, ask your stores to carry, you know, own voices, diverse romances.
Ask your library too,
and writers
that supports,
you know,
writers as well.
Yeah.
Right.
So the question is about accessibility. And the thing is, because the model so far has been for, you know, more white books or romances than anything else, I don't think even the publishers or anyone know how to market the own, the own voices, the marginalized voices.
Because so publishing is very white.
Yes.
Incredibly white.
So they are trying. It's a long road. You know, it's not as if they're not trying, but it's a long road. And as she said, there are several levels that need to change. So if any of you are interested, then seek them out. I mean, you can Google, you know, names, books, and then, you know, pass the word on. It's right now, it's a lot of word of mouth.
Word of mouth is so important in a lot of ways. And it's just, if you want to support a particular subgenre, any kind of book at all, you know, gay vampires or whatever, you know, your fancy may be, you know, you kind of have to buy all those books. When you find one that you love, tell your friends about it and say, this is awesome. You will love it.
And that, if I can do any recommending, it's my favorite thing in the world to do. I read a romance novel a day. It comes to me after. And
Sarah has a list on her website of like the 150 like romance novels where you, it's up to 200 now, where like you pick one off the page and you can't go wrong.
Well, I like to think so. None of them are written by me.
In my research, I've discovered a lot of talk about how women are described in romance novels, and in, especially in regards to like over-sexualizing them or whatever. And I didn't know how to feel about that, because on the one hand, I feel like we read romance novels to kind of want that idealized thing, and then on the other hand, like, we also want something we can relate to. And I didn't know how to balance that. So I was wondering if
okay, so the thing about romance is you're bringing two people together, you're making them fall in love. They are going to be beautiful in each other's eyes.
Yes.
And we're looking at, you know, we're looking at the other protagonist through their eyes. And so the whole question of why are we only writing about beautiful people is because we are hormonally required to, since we're since they are falling in love. You can sort of change that around a bit, you can do pretty much what you want to your own characters, but the thing is that their love interest is always going to think they're beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the greatest love stories I ever saw was on Oprah, and it was this couple, I have no idea what the topic of the show was, but they were middle-aged, they were not conventionally attractive people. They were very ordinary looking people. They were a classic dad who was losing his hair and had a little bit of a gut, and a mom who, you know, had obviously not lost all her baby weight. They were so hot for each other. Yeah. The woman said something like, well, when I want to get his attention, I vacuum naked, and he pipes up, not for long, she doesn't. Their teenage kid was on the show with him, got up, walked off the stage.
Yeah.
I was like, nobody would look at these people and say they are beautiful, but to each other, they are the sexiest thing on 2 feet. And so I try to keep that in mind, that in the eyes of someone who loves you, you are gorgeous, you are beautiful. And so he's going to, or she is going to think, you are hot, you are beautiful and sexy and wonderful. And so I try to balance that description that, you know, when it's coming from the partner, yeah, it's sexual because my characters have sex. That's part of love and attraction. And, you know, in the eyes of the other people in the book, they may be like, her, really? That's the one you want? Yeah. But to him, yeah, she is. She's the one I want more than anybody.
Also, that's sort of an id story, right? Like the beautiful to only one person, right? It's she's all that, right? Where, you know, she takes off. Is it she's all that? Where she, yeah. The it's the makeover, right? Like, which is a, there's a PhD in anthropology named Jennifer Lynn Barnes, and she does a lot of research on what she refers to as universal ids in literature. She's also a primatologist. She spent a lot of time like on an island, just her and like 500 monkeys. If you look her up, there's a great TED talk by her. But she talks about these sort of like universal id, like itch scratching stories. And one of them is the makeover because we, none of us feel beautiful all the time. And many of us don't feel beautiful ever. Right. So that sort of moment where you are seen for your beauty is really, I mean, it's just a one, we've all seen it in movies. We've all read it in books and it's a, it is a, an itch scratch. Right. So, and I also think gone are the days of like the perfect Disney heroine in like a Judith McNaught novel who like where birds alight on her shoulders and she like tames wild wolves. Like you can write whoever you want to write and readers will go with you.
Oh, anybody else?
Yeah. I would like to add that when I read a meat scene where, you know, they gaze across the room and tingles explode and the word tingle makes me grit my teeth.
Yes.
because, and I often write people who are not, they aren't beautiful. You know, one of them, they need glasses. He has a big nose. You know, her chin is stubborn. First of all, as a writer, when you are describing your characters, you're trying very hard to slip in a little symbolism with that stubborn chin or the shoulders that could hold up the world. Or she walks too fast, and you can always hear her coming across the room, which is unladylike. So you're looking for honesty in the symbolism of your character descriptions. But I think often what happens in a well-written meat scene is not the tingles and the sizzles and the hubba hubba paw and snort. That is unbecoming behavior. It's that the we've all probably at a younger age experience something like that for a screen idol where it's safe and there's, you're not going to get pawed and snorted at in return. But when it's a real person, what may be happening in a meat scene is you catch a glimpse of the honest, true person that they struggle very hard to keep out of sight and to be known, to be seen for who you are, to be seen as beautiful in your humanity is the stuff of immortal chemistry. So I think that's, as you're reading meat scenes, look at what's really being described and what's really being done there, because it's not just about cleavage.
One more. Did you want to?
Oh, I don't think I can top that, but you can.
I'm thinking, I didn't realize that this was about romance, so, and yet I have these preconceived notions.
I wouldn't kill the protagonist at the end. I wouldn't kill the protagonist at the end.
Yeah, that helps.
Which is what a lot of great American novels do.
Yeah, it's a great question. We are actually beneath the room, so we do have to wrap up. If you want to talk to the authors outside, they're about to go and sign their books, and they can share their thoughts with you then. So thank you all very much.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you, guys.
Sure.